This is Fresh Air, the Morgan Neville documentary series SNL 50. It was co-directed by my guest, Amir Questlove Thompson. He's the co-founder of the hip-hop band The Roots, which is the house band for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, who is a former SNL cast member. Questlove has become one of Fresh Air's most frequent guests because he does so many interesting books and movies in addition to his work with his band on and beyond The Tonight Show. Questlove actually has two new documentary films. The second is about Sly and the Family Stone. It's called Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius. It premiered over the weekend at the Sundance Film Festival and will start streaming on Hulu February 13th. We'll talk about that documentary in the next few weeks. His 2021 documentary, Summer of Soul, about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, won an Oscar for Best Documentary. Amir, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on.
Thank you for having me.
Were The Roots ever on SNL?
You know, it's weird. I've been on SNL in every configuration except for the one that I want to be on, which is actual music guest. Like, I've been a punchline on Weekend Update. I've been part of a Timothy Chalamet sketch. I've been mentioned in monologues. I've been in, like, a Lonely Island sketch. But I guess one could say that my dream, one of the main reasons why I was excited to be on The Tonight Show like 16 years ago when we first got offered the position, I was like, great, this puts me within like one degree of the brass ring, which is, you know, doing SNL. So, you know, kind of funny how I'm a part of that ecosystem almost in every way, but the one way I want to be, which is like musical guest one day. But, you know, The Roots are working on their 17th album right now. So, you know, I'm still hanging on to my dream.
Good. So do you think that the Saturday Night Live band, particularly in the Paul Schaefer era, though I don't know what era you started watching. I assume it was Paul Schaefer.
The very beginning. So my Saturday Night Live obsession really starts with, you know, the epicenter of my entire music world is Soul Train. And it just so happens that, you know, for most of America, especially with Soul Train in its prime, you know, everyone has a Saturday afternoon, 12 p.m., cleaning the house, watching Soul Train experience. But in Philadelphia, kind of weird, my Soul Train experience was always at 1 a.m. And so I had parents that were very forward-thinking, very cool. And of course, I'd have to be in bed at like 8:30 p.m. So whenever like the Love Boat theme starts, it's like, gotta go to bed. Not with that deep voice, but yeah, basically gotta go to bed. And the agreement was that be in bed at 8:30 and then at 12:30, midnight, we will wake you up. And by 12:30, Weekend Update is over for SNL. And then their music guest does two songs. And so I would go downstairs, turn on the TV, watch the two songs from SNL, whoever the music guest was, and then Soul Train comes on at 1 a.m. And then I'm in bed at 2 a.m. and up for church at 7:30 a.m. That's pretty much like my life from like 5 until maybe 11. Then Soul Train started coming on like in the afternoon. But I never stopped watching SNL. So, you know, I was there from the very, very beginning. It was nothing like it. I know that's the cliche that you're going to hear a lot about this 50th anniversary, but there was truly nothing like it on television.
One of the questions that you ask both cast members and people behind the scenes at SNL is, can you hum the SNL theme?
Yeah.
And so I want to play the attempts to hum the theme and then talk to
yes.
you about it.
Okay.
I can't hum the theme either.
Hey, no one can.
I immediately went to the actual theme. And I want to, before we hear it, I want to challenge our listeners to just pause and think for a second if they can hum the theme. Now let's play the theme. You know what I realized listening back, which I hadn't ever really thought of before?
What?
There isn't a melody. I mean, it's like you're coming in the middle of an improvisation.
It's the most iconic nondescript theme song. And kind of in my, that was my first realization back when I would, pretty much any Saturday that the Roots aren't touring and they're taping, I'm in the audience watching. And that to me is one of the most humorous things ever. Like, wow, like, you know it, you know it when you hear it, you know that's SNL, but no one can, it's a feeling. It's almost like it's the last theme that offers a feeling, but not any evidence of it. I don't know, it's like trying to put water in your pocket or something like that. Like, it's abundant, but it's not, it's whatever you want it to be.
Now, you wrote the theme for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.
Yes.
And it's almost as if to avoid people saying, I can't hum the theme, you and the band actually kind of hum scat the theme.
Well, the weird thing was, it was by accident. You know, our very that theme for The Tonight Show, the infamous Hey, 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 Hey song, was literally, we were kind of making fun of Santana's So Cool. And, you know, it was like, we were just sound checking. Like, we literally got, there was like our first day on the job, and they were like, all right, guys, play something. And we just started, you know, mocking a Santana song and just started singing a whole bunch of Hey, Hey, Hey's, and then attempted to write about 19 themes, none of which Jimmy liked. And at the end of the thing, he heard the song we were mocking. It was like, that's the song. We're like, well, no, we're just messing around. Like, that's not a real song. He's like, yes, it is. And so that wound up being the song. It's ear candy. But I admire the fact that SNL for 50 years has been able to provide a feeling without necessarily melodic evidence to it.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of your theme.
Okay.
For The Tonight Show. So, having gone through 50 years of musical guests, what's one of the performances that had a big impact on you when you were a kid and had to be in bed at 8:30, but you managed to watch Saturday Night Live?
I will say that, you know, the first 5 years was pretty much, you know, SNL, the role of SNL was, that was our YouTube, that was our viral video. For me, that was the one place where I could watch. At the time, I think my all-time favorite artist was Bill Withers. You know, there really just wasn't a show in which you can see actual musicians playing. I mean, you could watch American Bandstand or Soul Train where they might be lip syncing. Occasionally on Soul Train, they play live. But, you know, back then it was slim pickings. Either Friday night you watched Midnight Special. Sometimes a rock concert would come on like Sunday nights. But basically, SNL was just it was a rare moment in which you got to catch a really cool band. So even like Devo coming on, like, I was 8 years old when they did the Jaco Homo song, Are We Not Men? We Are Devo. And like, me and my cousins' minds were blown, you know. So practically any group that came on in the first 5 to 6 years, I was an instant fan of.
One of the things that you highlight in the SNL documentary is the role of SNL in the world of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
And tell the story of how Deborah Harry basically broke hip-hop on SNL.
Okay, so Saturday Night Live is the first time that America and the world will get to see what hip-hop culture is. The very first rap performance on TV is when Deborah Harry hosts the show in 1981 and brings on a Sugar Hill act called the Funky Four Plus One More. And she took a liking to this group, even though there were other popular groups at the time, like there was Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and the Sugar Hill Gang, both like platinum hits and really music and culture changing songs at the time. But she took a liking to this group because It was similar to Blondie, a band that had a woman in the lead of it. And so she took a liking to them. And for me, that's such an SNL move where, you know, those first 10 years, they weren't about, well, who's the most popular person to bring ratings in? It was always like the cool factor, like, okay, who's the most popular person now? Who's the person under that person that we could give a boost to? And that's like a prime example of how cool, how SNL always had their finger on the pulse of, you know, who's next. And, you know, as a result, come 20 years later, a lot of those first time acts, you know, your early hip hop groups, like, you know, them getting Run DMC before Run DMC was Run DMC, or them getting Prince before Prince was Prince, or the Talking Heads or Devo, whoever, like a lot of those risks that they took in the first 10 to 15 years, those guys will wind up being like the household names and the fiber of the mainstream once SNL becomes the mainstream instead of the underground. So, but yeah, with Deborah Harry using her power to bring attention to a culture that no one knew about, like that is a prime moment of the SNL effect and how it builds American entertainment culture.
Some of my favorite parts of the movie are the stories about things that have gone wrong, mm-hmm. followed by clips of showing what went wrong mm-hmm. and how it really, really shocked everybody behind the scenes.
Right.
And one of those stories is Elvis Costello. So, you know, he does one song during dress rehearsal that I guess he and Lorne Michaels had agreed on.
Right.
And then he stops it after a few bars. Let's hear what happens.
Here's Elvis Costello.
In the dress rehearsal, we did a song that was on my first album, but I thought it sounded a little too slow. It was a medium tempo song, and I didn't think it was exciting enough. And I realized this show is live. We can do anything we want.
Calling Mr. Ozzel with the swastika tattoo. There is a vacancy waiting.
Stop! I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. There's no reason to do this song here.
When he stopped, the hubbub in the studio was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God, what's going to happen? You can hear it.
Radio, radio. One, two, three.
With the Elvis thing, I was sitting with Dan Aykroyd on home base. You're just watching him. I'm going, oh, I think we're being hijacked.
I was tuning in the shine of the light that dialed doing anything my radio advised. Whenever one of those late night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes.
All of this stuff, it builds up in legend in the retelling. But I didn't come out there to give a political lecture. You know, I came out to kind of shake it up.
They say you had better do as you were told. You better listen to the
As we finished the song, the initial reaction in the moment was, I think we better get out of here. Somewhere in it, somebody said in anger, you'll never work on American television again. But the idea I was banned from television is nonsense.
That's such a great story. I love it. And I think you made a good choice. I love both songs, but I do think you made the right choice.
He made the absolute right choice. And, you know, that's the thing about SNL is there's a risk factor involved. And usually it starts with no. Like Eddie Murphy talks about, I did not want to do Hot Tub with James Brown. Justin Timberlake goes on and on about trying to convince Beyonce to do this single lady sketch. Like everything starts at no. And it's like, wow, like you almost talked yourself out of history. And I'm trying to get people in the mind state that, you know, oftentimes we get in our own heads about why something won't work. And sometimes you just got to take a risk. And you never know. This might be part of the American fiber, the history of it. But also, I know people have so many questions about what happens on a live show if something goes wrong. Like, for me, one of my favorite clips is the Ashley Simpson moment where you hear the directors freaking out because they don't know what to do. Should I go to commercial? What do I do?
Describe what happened.
Well, you know, Ashley Simpson had a sore throat and was a little iffy about her singing, so she opted to lip sing instead. And her drummer, who's controlling all the music, accidentally plays the wrong song for the second song. And
he, in fact, plays the song that we already heard as the first song.
Right, so exactly.
Everyone in the audience knows this is wrong, and there's no way of covering that up.
Well, yeah, I mean, they could have just patiently just stopped the song and started all over again as if nothing happened. But, you know, she infamously does a weird dance and runs off stage, kind of humiliated, and they go to a commercial. It just so happens that Oz Rodriguez, my co-director of this documentary, said that, you know, they also have the audio recording of the production room, like what was happening at the time. And for me, it was so hilarious to hear the producers and the directors inside of the control room. It sounds, to me, it sounds like a bunch of teenagers that stole their parents' car in San Francisco. And then the car is like, the brakes just give out in a San Francisco hill going down 100 miles per hour. Like, what do we do? Oh, no. Oh, no. You know, so I love showing, like, not how the sausage is made, but, you know, you get to see what's under the trunk. And that, to me, is the most fascinating part of SNL, like how it's able to happen every week without fail.
Let's hear some of what happened behind the scenes.
Uh-oh. On a Monday.
Wrong song. This is bad. They should play it.
And it was just like, you know, those old movies of two locomotives hitting each other, full bore.
What are we doing? I don't know, she should sing.
People were running in and out of the studio, and it just seemed like the show came to a screeching halt.
And the rumors were after that, I think there were two rumors after that, if mm-hmm. I remember correctly. One was that, oh, she really can't sing, so... not because of a sore throat, but because she's not capable of singing live. And right. therefore, they had to have her lip sync. And the other rumor was, oh, there's probably lots of acts that are really lip syncing.
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, we went through this like 10 years before with Milli Vanilli. You know, the kind of, this is what I call the post-thriller effect of 1982. Where suddenly your music video became the most important way to sell the song. And, you know, it came to the point where if you're in concert, fans expect whatever you did on your video, you would have to surpass it. And, you know, because Michael Jackson's introducing this whole idea of like, not only do you have to sing the song, but you have to sell the song, dance the song, act the song. For most people, it's hard enough just to sing it, but also to sing and perform or dance or whatever you have to do. Since the 80s, there have been options on how to sell the song without you giving up your voice or whatever. And so, I mean, kind of the lip singing aspect has been a thing since the early 80s. But for me as a musician, that's just a fact of life. But for a lot of people, there's a smoke and mirror aspect to it. And I guess with that Ashley Simpson performance, you know, most of America found out that half their favorites kind of do that. Like, it's just the standard.
Really?
I don't want to pop any more balloons than I have to, but it's just, again, like, from the artists that I talk to, it's like they might get in their heads that, you know, if I move too much and I'm out of breath, then I won't be able to hit the notes like I normally do. And, you know, I think people, again, the thriller effect is it must be perfect. And I'm kind of from the school of warts and all. Like, I love seeing the warts. I love seeing the pimples, the mistakes. Like, to me, that's the human touch. And I think people need to trust that more. Like, you know, things don't have to be Instagram filter perfect 24/7.
So I assume that what they're lip syncing to is a live performance. That's not the record.
There's some people, you know what? There's a few artists that are smart enough that will maybe do 8 specific takes of a particular performance so that you're under the impression that they are, you know, what's up, Detroit? How y'all doing? You know, like, they'll go that far. Like, I know artists that will do, like, 10 or 20 versions of a song to sort of customize or not get caught out there. But I think just in the name of presenting a perfect package, that's what people go through.
But, so you're talking about in concert right now, right?
Yeah, in concert or most, you know, I'm on television. I'll say that 90% of you know, it's very rare for a person to just go 100% live. Like I'll say that on The Tonight Show, 85 to 90% of what you see is a perfected delivery. Like in their minds, it's like, I must sell the song to sell my album. And so they don't want to leave risk or to chance any, you know, any flub that would make you say, nope, I don't, that note was flat, so I'm not supporting that group. So, yeah, that's kind of where we are now in entertainment.
Well, you solve one mystery for me, which is how do singers manage to sing when they're doing this elaborate workout with their choreography when you're going to be out of breath?
Exactly. So pretty much it's just par for the course. Like it's always been that way. But when I go to SNL, I'm entertained by what I see, but I'm not sitting in the audience just to watch Saturday Night Live. Like for me, the best part of the show is what happens in the commercials, like watching the Teamster guys and the crew guys, like at furious pace in 2 minutes, like build an entire set while, you know, they're quick, the artists are quick changing in the back and, well, they make it in 2 minutes flat. And to me, that's the best part of the show, like watching the choreography of a well-oiled machine.
So, you know, we were talking a little bit about how you ended up being the band leader of The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Did Paul Schaefer or any subsequent band leaders influence your, like how you wanted to be, both as an individual and as a band on The Tonight Show?
Absolutely. So even though Paul Schaefer was the first generation SNL late night band, when Paul went to the David Letterman show, which, you know, I will say the David Letterman talk show, especially in its first 10 years, it was such a kind of 80s counterculture moment. My parents always felt that those guys were hip, even though they were like totally nerdy. They kind of liked the irony hip, the nerdy hip of Paul and David Letterman. And so as a kid, I just, you know, Paul was just like the coolest guy ever. And so, you know, I mean, at the time, I didn't realize as a 10-year-old that, you know, someone were to come to me and say, you know, young man, in 35 years, that will be you on television. Like, my version of, you know, A Christmas Story, you know, like my Jacob Marley. But to me, when I was offered the late night thing, when you're doing the pros and the cons of it all, in my head, I was like, wow, you know, this is my chance to be the Paul Schaefer. But Paul's very unique. I'm definitely not the Paul Schaefer of The Tonight Show. Like, you know, Paul and David almost have this Run DMC-esque finish each other's sentence kind of camaraderie going on. I'm not there with Jimmy yet, but, you know, I've made my mark still.
So several of the people who have been music guests on Saturday Night Live talk about how nervous they were the first time around or the only time around. And one of them is Dave Grohl, who talks about how his first appearance with Nirvana, he was so nervous, he played so hard. He said, when I get nervous, I play really hard, that he broke like a drumstick within 20 seconds and a little while later broke through the skin of one of his drums. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if that's something you have to deal with on The Tonight Show. Do you ever have to calm down guest artists who either get nervous in front of an audience in general or just get nervous because they're not really used to, you know, national TV?
All the time. I can tell what type of artist we're dealing with based on how late the camera blocking, the rehearsal, the day of is. And kind of a way that artists handle that control issue is usually with time. Oftentimes we'll get an artist that will drag their feet. You know, they're it's now 10 minutes late. It's now 15 minutes late. And, you know, the artists don't understand, like, blue collar and white collar office politics. Like, hey, we're a union group and we have to take an hour break at this specific time. And, you know, the things that they don't generally get, you know, artists are sometimes in their own ecosystem, their own world, their own bubble, where they're not thinking like, oh, am I going over union time? Like, we might have to do lunch and a half, or, you know, like things that only office people understand. And I learned long ago, like, this is why I'm really big on micro meditation and, you know, just sitting in a quiet room for like 10 minutes before I go on, because sometimes you have to just calm yourself down so that you can really focus on what you have to do. But a lot of times artists are in their own heads and they often talk themselves out of, you know, the magic, because they're, when you're worrying, you're almost praying for something bad to happen. Like, that's my definition of worrying. Like, oh, I hope I don't mess up. You're basically saying, hey, I would like to mess up, just subconsciously. So as a result, most artists will stall, take their time, be an hour late, be 2 hours late, not show up at all, hijack their career in the name of fear. And as always, like, once you do it, then it's like, oh, that's all it was. No big deal. But, you know, I'm used to it because I've been doing this for a couple of decades. But oftentimes I'll pull an artist to the side and just be like, OK, I want you to listen to my voice. I want you to inhale, exhale. I do that a lot to them, especially the new artists that are like nervous and scared.
You can't say, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. It's just national TV.
Nah, see, the people in their heads, and, you know, it's a tightrope walk, and I get it. Like, it's easy to think, like, what if I fail? What if this doesn't work? What if no one likes me? But, you know, there's another side of that coin, which is like, what if this works out? What if everyone loves me? You know, again, leading to the slide doc, one of the biggest themes is, you know, there's a fear of failure. But the bigger fear is actually the fear of success. Like, what if it does work?
Amir, it's been so great to talk with you. Thank you for being such a regular guest on our show. It's really, it's a joy.
Thank you.
Amir Questlove Thompson's new film, Ladies and Gentlemen, 50 Years of SNL Music, is part of SNL's 50th anniversary celebration. It premieres on NBC tonight and starts streaming on Peacock tomorrow. There's a part two of that interview in which we talk about another new Questlove documentary about Sly Stone and his band Sly and the Family Stone. It's called Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius. It just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and will start streaming on Hulu February 13th. We'll feature that interview sometime in the next few weeks. This is Fresh Air.